Okay, we're going to come together for minor prophets. Yay. Before we get into class, though, just some discussion about things for the end of the semester. So if you were in theology, and you were, I just kind of replay that whole entire speech about how the semester is going to end, except all the stuff about what we're going to talk about, because in minor prophets, we're not going to talk about the Trinity in the same degree. So, same kind of thing. We do have a class in Minor Prophets next week that during the chapel series. We will have one day where we do Minor Prophets twice. The point of that is that there will not be any in-class instruction that's left. We'll have everything done by the time Thanksgiving comes as far as instruction in the class. If you look at the syllabus, what'll happen is I didn't put the date in for when that will be so that we don't have to worry about it, but it's going to make your exam, your last exam here will be the last day before Thanksgiving, which is, I believe, when the theology exam is. I'm sorry that they're doubled up. I try to keep them from not doing that, but it's the end of the semester. I can't help everything. So it'll be at the same point in time. Same kind of thing for this class as theology in terms of if you have the 94 or later or higher in terms of grade, you can just take whatever your grade is, you can take as the final, your score for the final. And that I will send out an email as quickly as I can get it graded. The only thing we're going to miss is there is a class on review and questions, which we're going to skip over. So if you have questions, you're welcome to give them to me, and I'll try to put them out or something. Answers. I'll give you answers, or I'll type it out so everyone can hear what the questions were if you have other questions about the minor prophets. But mostly it's just a buffer class to give us time in a normal semester to kind of work around when we put the final and that kind of thing. So it'll be there. Final, if you take it, will be from the tests themselves. And it'll be the same kind of structure. It'll be online, but like same kind of thing where you'll have a basic part and then you'll have a part that you type in some answers to.
So there will be a final test after Thanksgiving for minor prophets?
Yes.
Unless otherwise specified by...
Yeah, unless you receive like the golden email. There will be a final. So it's not... I mean, once it's up, you can take it whenever... it's available. I'm going to try to have for my classes all those things up by Thanksgiving. So when you guys leave, you can do it any time that's convenient between then and the end of the semester as you want. If you want to give me a few days to kind of get stuff graded so you can find out if you have to take it, welcome to do that. If you're like, hey, I don't care, I just want to take it, that's fine too. You'd be welcome to do that. There was something else I was going to mention, but I don't know what it was. Are there any questions about the ending, then how this class will end?
So the exam will be on the 23rd, right? Or is it?
Yeah.
Or is it on the 25th?
No, it'll be the 25th. Right? That's that Wednesday. My dating got funky because I knew when I got down to the dates that there was supposed to be an extra day. Let me pull up my calendar. And so I kind of left it open. Yeah. So it'll be on the Wednesday the 25th. Oh, wait. Let me think about this. You know what? There is not a Minor Prophets class next week for chapel, I don't think. So it'll be as scheduled. So the exam would be on the 25th, but maybe we don't have a chapel next week.
But we have a chapel next week.
And do the exam on the Monday? Yes. If everyone is fine with that, I think you guys don't have, like, you guys have a lot more empty hours, I think, in the chapels and the seniors or freshmen. So if you guys are comfortable with that, I'll work it out with the registrar. And we could do a Minor Prophets class during chapel. Does that make sense? Everyone happy with that? You'd be good with that? It would let you not have tests back to back, which would probably be really good for you, also good for me in terms of grading. So I will speak with the registrar and see if we can do that. I do have your test graded from Micah, but not everyone has had an opportunity to take the test because everyone's, you know, in and out of quarantine with whatever they have that is not COVID. So once I get all those done, you'll get those back, but they are completed as far as everything. And we'll get back to you as quickly as I can. All right, any other questions? Okay, then let's jump into Minor Prophets, into Joel. I'm going to leave. We're going to go through class a little quick today. But we will still have some projecting stuff. All right. We're going to talk about Joel somewhere in here. Where is he? There he is. Joel. Let's deal with background for Joel. We don't know anything about Joel. That's the author. Oh, we know his name. His name is Joel. We know his father because he tells us he's the son of Penuel. That's about all we know about Joel. He provides virtually no details about himself. The only things we kind of surmise is that the stuff he talks about tends to be more true of Judah. So he seems to be dealing more with Judah than Israel. So we assume he's prophesying to the southern kingdom, to the kingdom of Judah. And that's about all we really know about him, just because there's not a lot of details in the book. So now you know what you need to know about Joel. The setting, the book itself is not dated. He doesn't tell us any kings or anything like that to date the book. And that serves as one of the biggest difficulties of the book. Like if you read commentaries and stuff, one of the biggest things everyone struggles with is when is it dated? You know, where are we going to put the book of Joel? A number of theories exist for the date, when it is. Some advocate for an early date, which would put it around the early to mid 9th century, so in the 800s somewhere, the 800s BC. That would be its early date. There are a couple factors that support this. One, the enemies that he mentions in the book would better fit the early enemies of Israel, of Judah. So it would make sense that it would be earlier in history rather than later, just based on the enemies that get talked about. The second thing that would support an early date is Joel's position in the Minor Prophets is earlier in the Minor Prophets. Now, if you'll remember when we talked about it at the very beginning, the Minor Prophets are a bunch of individual books. They get stuck together in one scroll. Generally, they go according to date, or roughly according to date. There are, if you look at the chart at the beginning of your notes, right, did I put a chart at the beginning of your notes? I am missing the page with the chart. But there's a chart at the beginning, right? I have page 3 as my first page. That's not good for me. That chart there, the chart of dates. You can kind of follow the dates down and see that they generally move from an early date to a later date as you go through the books. There are two prophets that have no date. Joel is one of those. And so there's debate about where it belongs. But because it's earlier in the list, in the arrangement, that's one of the reasons everyone says, well, it probably got, you know, associated with these other prophets because it was written at an earlier time too. Neither one of these is definitive. They're just some evidence for why it would be earlier in time. And so we go with this early date. Arguments for other periods of time, of course, can be made. His message and what he says in the prophecy is actually similar to Ezekiel and Jeremiah. Now, Ezekiel and Jeremiah were contemporaries of one another, around 600 when Jerusalem was being conquered in 587, 586 in that area. So the content of what he's telling Israel seems very much like Ezekiel and Jeremiah. And so some people say, no, it has to be a much later date. So it's kind of like he could be one of the earliest prophets in the minor prophets, or one of the last prophets. Not totally, because we have those post-exilic three at the end, but aside from those three, he would be one of the last guys. He talks about in the prophecy there's some discussion of a divided land that could be assumed regarding the later date. There's nothing definitive. So you can pick which position you want. Unless it's on a test in this class, and for that you should go with the earlier date, which is how it's dated in the notes, in that chart, and everything like that, because I personally think I'm going to go with the earlier date. And I do that in part because of where it's at in the Minor Prophets, even though that really means nothing. Okay, that's not definitive, it's not proof of anything. I just feel like I'm going to give it some credence, and the date doesn't matter a lot. So even though this is a really big debated thing, it's not going to change how you read the book of Joel. It's just going to be its own statement. And it's fun to debate people and tell them why they're wrong. So now you can pick a position and do that. Themes in the book. The major theme of Joel is the day of the Lord. Joel uses the occasion of a locust invasion to speak of the culminating judgment of God. So the day is coming in which God will bring judgment. This judgment will come to Israel, but Joel also clarifies that judgment will come to nations, and Israel will ultimately be exalted and restored. So the day of the Lord is the primary theme of the book of Joel. Some have, if you're going to go with a later date for the book, this is the argument people have for why Joel would be so early in the list of minor prophets, or in the arrangement, is because he deals with this day of the Lord, so it sort of sets a tone for all of the others. Not enough of a tone that it would go before Hosea, apparently, but it's early enough. It sort of sets this idea. What's interesting is later in the minor prophets, you run into Zephaniah, and Zephaniah, his theme is also the day of the Lord. Like, that's the thing they're both almost entirely consumed with, both books. So they kind of create this flow to the whole 12. Okay, let's jump in the actual text. Joel 1:1. The word of the Lord that came to Joel, the son of Pethuel. This is a simple introduction to Joel's prophecy. He explains the purpose, which is to convey the word of the Lord, and he identifies himself. I am Joel, or Yael, the son of Pethuel, and that's what we know. And now you know everything you know about Joel as a person. He's told you everything he wants you to know, and he gets right into the prophecy. So the first section of the prophecy through chapter 1 is about this locust invasion. So you read, as you just read through, "Hear this, you elders, give ear, all inhabitants of the land. Has such a thing happened in your days or in the days of your fathers? Tell your children of it. Let your children tell their children and their children to another generation." And so what's going on is Joel describes this invasion of locusts that have come through and destroyed an entire season of crops. And in fact, in verse 4, he talks about a number of distinct locusts. Now, I personally don't know a lot about locusts. It's never been that kind of an interesting thing to me. Or grasshoppers have never really been. I mean, I know what grasshoppers are, and I used to catch them as a child. I caught grasshoppers as a child, and maybe I played with them. I know what they are, but they're different types, right, of grasshoppers, but they're all grasshoppers to me. Different type of locust, but they're all just locusts to me. I don't care about all the types. But Joel lives in a society, an agrarian society, where it's really important. And so they have all the different types of locusts. And he says, this is what happened. Our crops were coming up. This locust came in. wiped a bunch out. And as soon as that locust was done, the next kind of locust comes in. So he goes through and you have the cutting one, the swarming one, the hopping one, and so on. They all came through and they ate our crops, destroyed everything. And it was so bad, he says, you need to tell, this is going to be an event that you're going to tell your children and they'll tell your grandchildren and even down another generation. They're going to be talking about this event for the next 60 years. That's how big this was. It was a terrible thing in terms of laying waste to the crops of devastation. The locusts, of course, in verses 5 through 14, wreaked havoc on the country. Even offerings have been cut off in verse 9. He says in verse 9, the grain offering and the drink offering are cut off from the house of the Lord. So bad was this locust invasion, we can't even worship God the way we ought to. Because it's all gone. They came in and ate all the stuff, so we can't give worship to God. We're certainly not going to be eating food the way we had. So with the crops gone, the nation is bereft of joy, and the nation is called to mourn. That's what Joel wants them to do. Come mourn over all this stuff. Verses 15 through 20, at the end of the chapter, Joel cries out in his prophecy, but we also see that the animals cry out, and the nation cries out. Everyone is upset. I have talked before about the cats in our house. It's very easy to know when their food bowl is empty, especially one of them who has nothing to do with me, the one without teeth. If I stand up too fast, she is the Frady cat type of cat. If I stand up too fast, she like scrambles and runs out of the room like I'm a terror, even though I'm just standing up. She will act all dramatic and run away from me. And it's all an act because there's other times where she doesn't do it, like when her food bowl is empty. And then like she'll come and she's suddenly all very affectionate and she'd be like, oh, you know, pet me. Oh, I love you. I adore you and things until her food bowl is full again. And then she's just like, ah, you're so tall and runs away. Joel is talking about a situation. We've lost all of the food. And so even our animals are suffering. We're suffering. Everyone's suffering because of this huge loss. That takes us into chapter 2, where Joel begins to look ahead. So he talks about, here's this experience you had with these locusts. He uses an event that was horrible, but was real, and something the people identified. We went through this terrible, terrible experience where we lost all of our crops. And now Joel is going to say, it's kind of like he's saying, remember that? There is a day coming which is going to reflect that. Except it's not going to be a day of locusts and a loss of crops. It's going to be enemies coming into Israel and a loss of people. So he begins talking about this coming invasion in chapter 2. In verses 1 through 11, we have a day of gloom and darkness. Because an army comes that intimidates the nations. And the army seems unstoppable, and God is using this army as it marches on Jerusalem, or on Israel, on Judah. And he kind of figures them the same way. They're like these locusts. These locusts came in, row after row after row, eating all of our stuff. These soldiers are going to come in like locusts, row after row. Like he says, they don't change direction, they just keep marching. Like they don't face something where they're like, oh, that's scary. Nope, they're going to just come right at it. And he says, that's what this day is going to be like. Verses 12 through 27, Israel is called to mourn and repent. This is the response you should have. You should repent. Yet, even now, declares the Lord, return to me with all your heart, with fasting and weeping and with mourning, and rend your hearts and not your garments. Of course, tearing the garment would be a sign of grief. It's a sign of mourning to rip your clothes in this culture. It's not now. Now it's a sign of privilege and wealth. But at the time, it was to show you were sad. So you would rip your clothes, and God says, don't do that. Rend your hearts. You need to get yourself right with me. Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love, and he relents over disaster. So this stuff is going to come, but you need to get yourself right with your relationship with God. This mercy through God's grace, they will find, they will have mercy, and God will bring restoration. He will repay them for all those things in verse 25. So we have this day that we all remember with the locusts. And Joel says, remember that because there's going to be a day come where it's not locusts, it's soldiers, and you're going to face this day. Then he goes even to a further day. There is an ultimate day coming where there will be total judgment. Oh, did you guys have blanks there? Sorry, I didn't have those in my notes. So repent and mercy.
Yay.
All right, then there's going to be a day of ultimate judgment in verses from the end of chapter 2 into chapter 3. Verses 28 through 32 of chapter 2. God will bring renewal to Israel. In this restoration, he will pour his spirit out on his people. He will bring salvation to all of his people. Of course, looking to Israel. He's going to save them from the circumstances of this judgment. As you get into chapter 3, for the first half of chapter 3, in addition to bringing restoration to Israel, God will also bring judgment to the nations. And that's going to be a frightful, frightful thing. Verse 15 of chapter 3. The sun and the moon are darkened and the stars withdraw their shining. So when God judges the world, it's going to be a global judgment. Even the sun is dark, or the moon is darkened. It connects to some of the things that we read in Joel, connects to some of the things that we would read in Revelation, as John is anticipating the same judgment in the tribulation. So Joel is anticipating that same set of circumstances. Wow, I don't know if my clicking is all off. Okay, God will bring judgment to the nations. It's going to be frightful. Then, in the end of the book, ultimately, through this judgment, God will be vindicated and proven holy. He will abundantly bless the people of Israel and bring forgiveness to them. So the book ends with comfort. There's going to be, you've gone through difficulty, there's still going to be difficulty coming, and there's going to be a final kind of judgment coming, but in the end, God will rescue his people. And Israel will be in the state of forgiveness and will be blessed by God. So it ends with positive things. Any questions on Joel? All right. Then we're going to skip over Amos because we've already talked about Amos. And let's go to Obadiah. Obadiah. When we talked about Joel, we ran into a problem because we don't know who Joel is. I mean, we know who he is, the writer, and we know his dad, and that's all we know. With Obadiah, we have almost the opposite kind of problem. There are, in background, 12 men named Obadiah in the Old Testament. That ranges from the early kingdom to after the exile. So we have Obadiahs all over the place. Could be any of them. The prophecy itself provides little historical or textual clues that would help us identify its author. Often, the prophet Obadiah is considered a 13th Obadiah in the Old Testament. So everyone was looking at the 12 Obadiahs we know, could be that Obadiah, could be that Obadiah, could be that Obadiah, and said, you know what? Maybe it's none of them. Obadiah is clearly a common name. Maybe this is just some other guy named Obadiah. Which seems reasonable to me. I think if it were one of the others, that would probably have gotten pointed out somewhere that he was a prophet or something like that, as they get mentioned. So I think he's probably just his own guy. He's Obadiah the prophet. He's not one of the others. In terms of setting, the prophecy provides little background on which to base a date. So like Joel, it's not dated. So little could be said of the setting. Obadiah writes in response to the actions of the Edomites, who had mistreated the Israelites and Jerusalem in particular. This could have referred to a number of incidents in Jerusalem's history. However, there are two particular ones that stand out where it could be either of them. The first is during the reign of Jehoram in 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 2. You would see that there was this thing where Israel and Edom had a scuffle. Which, incidentally, I went back and reread stuff. Yes, and Carlin was correct that it was the line of Ahab. It was Joram that was killed by Jehu. But he was Ahab's grandson, I think. So it was line of Ahab if you want to go back and correct your notes. Sadly, my notes are not inspired. They're just really, really good. So I'm short of inspiration. So Joram, this could be the first incident that Obadiah was speaking to. The other one would be during the Babylonian invasion, and that would be at the end of 2 Kings. Of these two, I personally prefer the first set, the one under Joram, the earlier date. It fits the events very well, and it also gives a reason for Obadiah's earlier place in the canon. So some of it is like Joel. I'm taking the earlier date because Joel is earlier in the canon, and Obadiah I'm treating somewhat the same way. It does fit the circumstances, though, well, and so that makes sense to me. I think if Obadiah were writing at the time, at the end of the, or with the Babylonian invasion, there were probably just other pressing things that God wanted to communicate. So, and he had other prophets doing that. And other prophets at that time, like Ezekiel, who prophesies against Edom, but doesn't seem to mention these things. So, God already had that handled then. So I think he was using Obadiah at this point. In terms of themes, Obadiah is a short prophecy that is focused on the judgment of Edom. For Judah, this would provide a sense of hope that God was aware of them and cared for them. If you've ever been oppressed, it's just kind of good to know someone sees, right? You don't always have to have a solution for when you're going through difficulty. Sometimes it's just nice to know other people see you going through difficulty. And that's a comforting thing. And I think that's some of what was happening here for Judah. All right, so let's kind of go through the book. Obadiah is fun because it is one chapter. So if you're ever doing sword drills with like youth or something, Obadiah 2-3 is always a fun one to make them go look for. And I love when kids stand up. You know you've always got those kids who like stand up immediately even though they're still like ch-ch-ch-ch. And you're like, no. You are a liar. And you can sing the song for them. You guys know the liar song? You want a fun little song? Okay. I learned this from my wife, but I think I learned. I know I had to learn it from my wife and her friend when I was, you know, trying to be very friendly and develop a relationship. So here goes. Revelation, Revelation 21:8, 21:8. Liars go to hell. Liars go to hell. There you go. All right. Now I've taught you a song. It's not a nice song, though. So use it sparingly. And if anyone ever asks you where you learned that, it was not in this class. All right, Obadiah, verse 3. Verse 1 is nice, the visions of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God, and he goes on concerning Edom. Verse 3, the pride of your heart has deceived you. You will live in the clefts of the rock, you who live in the clefts of the rock, in your lofty dwelling. Edom inhabited an elevated land with high cliffs, especially on the western side, which is the side that would face Israel. So these fortresses gave Edom the sense of being invulnerable, and the emphasis on the height is also found in verse 4. So they had like these rocky, craggy cliffs, and they built their dwellings back up in here. Because if you can build your house in the side of a cliff, that's a really good place to build it. Because people aren't going to be able to come, literally in a wall. You're not going to have forces come up and kick you out. It's hard to get to someone who's in the side of a cliff. Of course, other people throughout the world have discovered this over time. So you have like the cliff dwellers in Colorado and things like that too, the Native Americans that have built their house there. It's just a nice strategic place. And so God is recognizing that. It's part of their culture that that's where they were putting their things. Verses 5 and 6, the judgment is certain, not only in its coming, but also in the nature of its destruction. It will be the utter destruction of the land. He says, if thieves came to you, if plunderers came by night, how you have been destroyed. Would they not steal only enough for themselves? So if someone comes and robs your house, they take what they can carry away. Now some of them come with a car or something so they can carry more away, but that's all they take. God says if it were thieves that were coming in, that's what they would take. If it were grape gatherers, they would take what they could gather, what they could carry away. How Esau has been pillaged, his treasures sought out. In other words, I, as God, am going to bring judgment. It's going to be a lot worse than that. Because I can carry everything away. And so it's not going to just be a small matter of destruction, but it's going to be everything. That's the certainty of Edom's judgment. The second section, verses 10 through 14, is the reason for Edom's judgment. So let's skip down to verses 10 and read that. Because of the violence done to your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. So Jerusalem was being attacked, and Edom was in a position that it could have helped and chose not to. So it stayed back so that the attack against Israel was successful. So this clarifies the reason that Edom is being judged, and that's because of the way they treated Israel. The term brother is reflective of their origins concerning Jacob and Esau. Edom comes from Esau. So they were kind of brothers in terms of nations. Although others are the ones who attacked Jerusalem, Edom did not help and joined with the attackers. They stood aloof. They sided with the attacker. You don't always have to be the instigator to be guilty. And that's the case here. Verses 13 through 14. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Do not gloat over his disaster in the day of his calamity. Do not loot his wealth in the day of his calamity. Do not stand at the crossroads to cut off his fugitives. Do not hand over his survivors in the day of his distress. So while certainly reflective of how Edom must have treated those in Jerusalem, this seems to hint at a future event as well, and perhaps anticipates the Babylonian invasion. That there's going to be another time where you, Edom, will have opportunity to help. And so what does God tell them to do? He says, don't stand back. Don't just let them run off. Don't become an obstacle. At that point, step in and help. This is part of why I think Obadiah is not writing about the Babylonian invasion himself when he's writing. Is because he makes this prophecy about some future things that would have been true at the Babylonian invasion. So I think he's dealing with one incident where this is how Edom behaved, but God is also addressing them. You're going to have another opportunity to do it right. So do it right then. Don't fail in regard to that. Because you're already facing judgment for doing it wrong now. Don't add more judgment to it. It ends with the glory of Edom's judgment. Verse 15. For the day of the Lord is near upon all the nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return on your own head. The judgment that is to be exacted on all nations occurs on the day of the Lord. Justice will be perfect. Nations will receive what they have earned. It is a scary thing to read this to me. I mean, the principle of it, right? That as you have done, so it shall be done to you. Now, I've done nice things for people, and so that would be nice. But I've also done not nice things to people. I've done a lot of not nice things over 40 years. And having all of that brought into account, having it all done to you in a moment, that would be not nice. Like, exclamation point. And so, it's a scary justice to realize God is fully and totally just. Verse 17, let's read, that was verse 15, so let's read 16. For as you have drunk on my holy mountain, so shall all the nations drink continually. They shall drink and swallow, and shall be as though they had never been. But in Mount Zion, there shall be those who escape, and it shall be holy. And the house of Jacob shall possess their own possessions. So there's kind of a turnabout here, and that's that Israel, during this judgment, Israel is going to be upheld, restored, and made holy. So all these other nations that are mistreating Israel now, God's going to call that into account. They will be judged for the way they treat Israel, and they're going to find themselves in this situation of terrible judgment. But Israel, in that period, is going to find itself redeemed by God. So it will be a good situation for them. Verses 18, the house of Jacob shall be a fire, the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau stubble. That is the waste that would burn up. They shall burn them and consume them, and there shall be no survivor for the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. So verses 18 through 19, specifically with this elevation of Israel, Edom is conquered, and the people of Israel will possess the land of Edom. They will take over that land, which is next to them. And finally, in verse 21, although Israel will be elevated, God is ultimately the Lord. He rules, thus Edom is judged, and Israel is exalted, because God is the one who's in charge. Any questions about that? Those things. Okay, I know it was a much quicker go today. It'll be very fun on Monday when we get to Jonah. Some fun things to talk about there. I will work stuff out with the registrar to see if we can get minor prophets added to the calendar for the chapel week next week. Otherwise, go with joy into the day. It looks pretty, so enjoy some of that.